This is the second half of the third chapter of An Outline of Esoteric Science by Rudolf Steiner. The chapter 3 is entitled Sleep and Death. I am on page 91 of that chapter, the 17th paragraph. Three distinct domains of the land of spirits appear to supersensible consciousness. They may be compared to three regions in the physical sense perceptible world. The first is the spiritual world's quote-unquote land masses, so to speak. The second is its quote-unquote bodies of water. The third is its quote-unquote atmosphere. In the first domain of the land of spirits, everything that assumes a physical shape on earth so that it can be perceived by means of physical organs is perceived according to its spiritual nature. For example, the force that gives a crystal its shape can be perceived in the land of spirits, but its manifestation there is the opposite of what appears in the sense-perceptible world, so to speak. To spiritual sight, the space occupied by a mass of rock in the physical world appears as a cavity of some sort, but the force that shapes the form of the stone is seen all around this cavity. The color the stone possesses in the sense-perceptible world appears as an experience of its complementary color in the spiritual world. Thus, from the viewpoint of the land of spirits, a red stone appears greenish and a green one is experienced as reddish. All other characteristics also appear in the form of their opposites. Just as things, such as stones and masses of soil, make up the sense-perceptible world's land masses or continents, the formations described above constitute the spiritual world's land masses. In quotes, everything that is life in the sense-perceptible world is the oceanic region in the spiritual world. To our physical eyes, life is evident in its effects in plants, animals, and human beings. To our spiritual eyes, life is a being that flows, permeating the land of spirits like seas and rivers. Better still, it can be compared to blood circulation in the body. Because the distribution of seas and rivers in the sense-perceptible world is irregular, while a certain regularity, like that of the circulating blood, is the rule in the distribution of flowing life in the land of spirits. At the same time, this flowing life is also heard. It resounds spiritually, as it were. The third domain of the land of spirits is its atmosphere, in quotes. Everything that appears in the sense-perceptible world as feeling exists in the spiritual realm as an all-pervading presence, just like the air on earth. We must imagine it as a sea of flowing feeling. Sorrow and pain, joy and delight flow throughout the domain like winds and storms in the atmosphere of the sense-perceptible world. Let's imagine a battle being fought on earth. Not only human figures with forms that can be seen with physical eyes confront each other here, but feelings confront feelings and passions confront passions. The battlefield is not only full of human figures, it is also full of pain. All the passions, the pain, and the joy of conquest that are active here not only manifest as sense-perceptible effects, but also become perceptible to spiritual senses as an atmospheric process in the land of spirits. In the spirit, an event like this is like a thunderstorm in the physical world. Spiritual perception of such events can also be compared to hearing words in the physical world. That is why it is said that, quote, wafting spiritual words, unquote, surround and permeate the beings and events of the land of spirits, just as air surrounds and permeates the beings of earth. Still other perceptions are possible in the spiritual world. Something comparable to the warmth and light of the physical world is also present here. The actual world of thoughts is what pervades everything in the land of spirits, like the warmth that pervades all earthly things and beings. Here, however, we must imagine these thoughts as living, independent beings. What we grasp as a thought in the manifest world is like a shadow of a thought being that is active in the land of spirits. Let's imagine that a thought is extracted from the human being in which it is present and is endowed with an inner life of its own as an active entity. We then have a feeble illustration of the content of the fourth domain in the land of spirits. What we perceive as thoughts in our physical world between birth and death is merely a manifestation of the thought world, shaped as the instruments of our various bodies permit. But all the thoughts we cultivate that enrich the physical world have their origin in this spiritual domain. We need not think only of the thoughts and ideas of great inventors or geniuses in this regard. We can see how we all have ideas that suddenly occur to us, not merely ideas that are due to the outer world, but ideas we use to transform this outer world. To the extent that we speak of feelings and passions whose causes lie in the outer world, these belong to the third domain of the land of spirits. But everything that lives in our souls in a way that makes creators of us, everything that allows us to transform and fructify our surroundings, is evident in its primal, essential form in the spiritual world's fourth domain. What is present in the fifth domain can be compared to physical light. It is wisdom, revealing itself in its primal form. Beings belonging to this domain pour wisdom out into their surroundings, like the sun that sheds light on physical beings. A thing is illuminated by this wisdom. Let me read that again. A thing that is illuminated by this wisdom shows its true significance and meaning for the spiritual world, just as a physical being shows its color when shown upon by light. There are still higher domains of the land of spirits, but that will be described in a later book of this later part of this book. After death, the eye, along with what it brings with it from life in the world of the senses, is immersed in the spiritual world. What its past life yielded is still united with the part of the astral body that is not discarded at the end of the purification period. As we have seen, only the part whose desires and longings are still directed toward physical life falls away after death. Immersing the eye and its past life's yield in the spiritual world can be likened to planting a seed in fertile soil. The seed draws on substances and forces from its surroundings in order to develop into a new plant. Similarly, development and growth are the very essence of the eye that has been immersed in the spiritual world. The force that creates an organ lies hidden within what that organ perceives. Our eyes perceive light, but without light there would be no eyes. Creatures that spend their life in darkness do not develop any organs of sight. Similarly, the whole bodily human being is created out of the forces lying hidden in what is perceived by the organs of our various bodies. The physical world is built up by the forces of the physical world, the ether body by those of the world of life, and the astral body out of the astral world. Now, when the eye is transported into the land of spirits, it encounters these forces, which are hidden to physical perception. In the first domain of the land of spirits, the spiritual beings that always surround human beings, building up our physical bodies, become visible to the eye. In the physical world, what we perceive is nothing other than the manifestations of these spiritual forces that have shaped the human physical body. After death, we find ourselves surrounded by these same formative forces, but now they show themselves in their true forms, which were previously concealed. Similarly, in the second domain, we find ourselves in the midst of the forces that make up the ether body, while in the third domain the forces that stream toward us have organized the astral body. What the higher domains of the land of spirits send toward us is also what constitutes our makeup during life between birth and death. From this point onward, these beings of the spiritual world work in conjunction with what we have brought with us as the fruit of our former life, which now becomes a seed. Through their interaction, we are first built up anew as spiritual beings. When we sleep, our physical and ether bodies persist. The astral body and the eye, although outside of these two bodies, remain connected to them. Any influences the astral body and the eye can receive from the spiritual world under these circumstances serve only to replenish the forces we have exhausted while awake. However, after the end of the purification period, when we have discarded not only the physical and ether bodies, but also the part of the astral body that still clung to the physical world through its desires, everything flowing from the spiritual world toward the eye serves not only to improve it, but also to reconfigure it. And after a certain period of time, parenthesis spoken of later on in this book, parenthesis, an astral body forms around the eye and becomes capable of living in etheric and physical bodies of the sort appropriate to human beings between birth and death. Then, we are ready to undergo birth again, and to appear in a new earth existence, which then incorporates the fruit of our previous life. Up to the point of forming a new astral body, we witness our own rebuilding. Since the powers of the land of spirits, like our self-aware eye, manifest from within rather than through outer organs, we are able to perceive their manifestations as long as our faculties are not yet directed toward an outwardly perceptible world. However, the moment the astral body has taken shape again, these faculties turn outward. From that point onward, the astral body again begins to demand an external ether body and physical body, and turns away from the revelations of the inner world. For this reason, an interim period of sinking into unconsciousness now begins. Consciousness will be able to appear again only in the physical world, when the organs necessary for physical perception have been formed. During this time, when the consciousness illuminated by inner perception has come to an end, a new ether body begins to connect to the astral body, and we can then enter a physical body again. The only I that would be capable of taking part consciously in reconnecting to these two elements would be one that had succeeded in creating a life spirit and spirit body, the creative forces hidden in the ether and physical bodies. Until we reach this stage, beings that are further along in their development than we are must direct this process of reconnecting. These beings lead the astral body to a set of parents so that it can be given the appropriate etheric and physical bodies. Before the connection to the ether body has been completed, something happens that is extremely significant for us as we enter physical existence again. As we have seen, each of us in our previous life created destructive forces that became evident during our journey backward after death. Let's look again at the example mentioned earlier. In the previous lifetime, the person in question, who was 40 years old at the time, caused pain to someone else in an outburst of anger, and later, after death, encountered that other person's pain as a force destructive to the development of his or her own eye. The same is true of all similar incidents in this person's previous life. These obstacles to development then confront the person's eye when it re-enters physical life. Just as the eye saw a kind of memory picture of the past life as death set in, it now has a preview of the life to come. Once again, this person sees a picture of this sort, but this time it shows all the obstacles that need to be overcome in order to make progress along the path of self-development. What is seen in this way becomes the starting point for forces that this person must take along into his or her new life. The image of the pain inflicted on another becomes the force that motivates the eye on re-entering life to make up for this pain. Thus our previous life has a determining effect on the new one. In a certain respect, our deeds in this new life are caused by ones in our previous life. We must see this lawful and regular connection between an earlier existence and a later one as the law of destiny. We usually apply the term karma, borrowed from Oriental wisdom, to this law. However, building up a new bodily organization is not the only activity that is required of us between death and a new birth. During this process, we live outside of the physical world. But meanwhile, the physical world continues to evolve. The face of the earth changes within a relatively short period of time. A few thousand years ago, what did the region look like that our country now occupies? As a general rule, when we appear on earth in a new existence, it does not look the way it did during our last lifetime. All kinds of things have changed in our absence. Now, hidden forces are also at work, changing the face of the earth. They work out of the world we find ourselves in after death, and we too must help to transform the earth. However, as long as we have not become clearly conscious of the relationship between the spiritual element and its physical expression by creating the life spirit and spirit body in ourselves, we require the guidance of higher beings if we are to assist in this transformation, but we do assist in it nonetheless. We can say that during the time between death and a new birth, we transform the earth in a way that aligns its conditions with what is developing within us. If we observe some spot on earth at a certain point in time, and again after a long time has elapsed, we find it in a totally different condition. The forces that have brought about this change are present among human beings who have died. This is how they are connected with the earth between death and rebirth. Supersensible consciousness sees manifestations of the hidden spiritual element in all of physical existence. To physical observation, what works at transforming the earth is the light of the sun, changes in climate, and so on. To supersensible observation, however, the forces of people who have died are active in the rays of sunlight falling on the plants. If we observe in this way, we become aware of human souls hovering around the plants, transforming the surface of the earth, and so on. In death, our attention is not focused only on ourselves and on preparing our own new earthly existence. No, we are also called upon to work spiritually on the outer world, just as we are called upon to work physically during life between birth and death. Not only does human life work on circumstances in the physical world from the land of spirits, but the reverse is also true. Activity in physical existence has its effects in the spiritual world. An example can illustrate what happens in this connection. A bond of love exists between mother and child. This love arises out of an attraction between the two of them that is rooted in the sense world, but it changes over the course of time. The sensory bond becomes more and more spiritual, and this spiritual bond is fashioned not only for the sake of the physical world, but for the land of spirits as well. This is also true of other relationships. What is fashioned in the physical world by spiritual beings persists in the spiritual world. Friends who have become intimately connected during life also belong together in the land of spirits. After they have discarded their various bodies, their togetherness is much more intimate than it was during physical life, for as spirits they are there for each other, in the same way that spiritual beings reveal themselves to others from the inside, as described above. Also, a bond that has formed between two people leads them together again in a new life. In the truest sense of the word, therefore, we must speak of people finding each other again after death. This process that takes place with human beings between birth and death, and then from death to a new birth, repeats itself. We return to earth again and again whenever the fruit of one physical lifetime has ripened in the land of spirits. Yet this repetition does not go on without beginning or end. At one point we left different forms of existence for ones that run their course as described here. And in future we will leave these and move on to others. An overview of these changing stages will be presented later, when the evolution of the cosmos in its relationship to the human being is described from the viewpoint of supersensible consciousness. Of course, the processes that take place between death and a new birth are even more hidden from outer sensory observation than is the case with the spiritual element underlying our existence as it manifests between birth and death. Sense perception can see the effects of this part of the hidden world only where these effects enter physical existence. For sensory observation, the question is whether human beings entering existence through birth bring along something of the processes that supersensible knowledge describes between a death and the next birth. Even if we find a snail shell with no trace of an animal in it, we will acknowledge that the shell came about through the activity of an animal. We will not be able to believe that this form created itself by means of mere physical forces. Similarly, if we observe people during life and discover something that cannot have originated in this life, it is reasonable to admit that it originates in what the science of the supersensible describes, if this sheds clarifying light on something that is otherwise unexplainable. Thus it is also possible for rational sensory observation to understand invisible causes through their visible effects. Any unbiased observer of our current life will find this more and more correct with each new observation. It is simply a question of finding the right point of view for observing effects in outer life. For example, where are the effects of what supersensible knowledge describes as processes belonging to the purification period? How do effects appear that belong to what we are supposed to experience after this realm of purification in the purely spiritual realm, according to details provided by spiritual research? If we reflect on life deeply and seriously, there are plenty of riddles that demand our attention in this particular area. We see one person born into poverty and misery, endowed with only meager talents and seemingly predestined for a pitiable existence because of the circumstances of his or her birth. Meanwhile, another person receives lavish care and attention from solicitous hands and hearts from the first moment of life, develops brilliant capabilities, and has all the potential for a fruitful and satisfying life. We can respond to such questions with one or two opposing points of view. The first one clings to what we can perceive with our senses and understand with our sense-bound intellect. This view does not question the fact that one person is born to happiness and another to misfortune. Even if it doesn't use the term chance, it will not think of assuming that there is some lawful interrelatedness that causes such disparities. And when it comes to potentials and talents, this way of looking at things will attribute them to what is inherited, unquote, in quotes, inherited, from parents, grandparents, and other ancestors. It will refuse to look for causes in spiritual processes undergone by the person in question before birth, processes that shaped his or her potentials and talents, yet are quite independent of his or her line of descent. However, there is also a second point of view that will feel unsatisfied with this interpretation, insisting that even in the manifest world, we do not see things happen in specific places or under specific circumstances without needing to assume that there are reasons why they happen. Even though these causes remain undiscovered in many instances, they are present nonetheless. Alpine flowers do not grow on lowland plains. There is something in their nature that brings them together with alpine surroundings. Likewise, there must be something in a person that causes him or her to be born into a particular environment. Causes that lie only in the physical world are not enough to explain this. To any more profound thinker, assuming that such causes are sufficient would be like assuming that the fact that one person hits another doesn't have to do with the feelings of the person doing the hitting, but only with the physical mechanism of his or her hand. This second viewpoint is equally dissatisfied with any explanation of predispositions and talents as qualities that are merely, quote-unquote, inherited. Nevertheless, it can be pointed out that certain abilities do run in families. Musical abilities were passed down in the Bach family for 250 years. Footnote, in the 17th and 18th centuries, this German family produced over 50 musicians. End footnote. The Bernoulli family produced 8 mathematicians, some of whom were earmarked for quite different careers as children. Footnote, a prominent family of mathematicians in Basel during the 17th and 18th centuries, Jakob Sr., 1654-1705, studied theology. Johann Sr., 1667-1748, studied medicine. And Jakob Hermann, 1678-1759, studied theology before turning to mathematics. Nikolaus Sr., 1687-1759, studied law. Nikolaus Jr., 1695-1726, studied mathematics and law. Daniel, 1700-1782, studied medicine. End of footnote. But their quote-unquote inherited talents always drove them into the family profession, after all. Furthermore, it can be pointed out that exact investigation of someone's line of descent always demonstrates that in one way or another this person's talents were evident in his or her ancestors and are only an accumulation of inherited tendencies. People who hold the second point of view will certainly not disregard such facts, but these cannot mean as much to them as they do to those who want to base their explanations purely on processes taking place in the sense-perceptible world. adherents of the second view will point out that it is just as impossible for inherited predispositions to assemble themselves into a unitary personality as it is for metal clock parts to assemble themselves into a clock. To the objection that the parents working together can bring about this combination of predispositions and that this takes the place of the watchmaker, as it were, they will reply, quote, "If you look at it impartially, you will find an element in each child's personality that is completely new. This cannot come from the child's parents, simply because it was not present in them." Unquote. Unclear thinking can cause a great deal of confusion in this area. The worst is if adherents of the first viewpoint see adherents of the second as opposing something that is based on positive fact, while it may not even occur to the latter to deny the truth or value of such facts. They too see quite clearly that a particular cultural predisposition or spiritual direction is, quote-unquote, passed down within a family, and that if certain predispositions are combined and accumulate, they can result in an outstanding personality. They are quite capable of agreeing that the most illustrious name almost always stands at the end of a bloodline rather than at the beginning. It should not be held against them, however, if they are forced to hold ideas that are quite different from those of people who choose not to go beyond sense-perceptible facts. These people can be rebutted by saying that individuals certainly do demonstrate certain characteristics belonging to their ancestors, because the element of spirit and soul that enters physical existence through birth derives its bodily nature from what heredity provides. However, this says nothing more than that a being shares the idiosyncrasies of the medium in which it is immersed. Unbiased minds will not deny the justification for the comparison, although it is certainly a strange and a trivial one, if we say that the fact that a human being appears clothed in the traits of his or her ancestors says just as little about the origin of this individual's personal characteristics as being wet from falling into the water says about the wet person's inner character. Furthermore, the fact that the most illustrious name stands at the end of a bloodline demonstrates that the bearer of this name needed that bloodline in order to fashion the body that was necessary for the development of his or her entire personality. This proves nothing about the quote-unquote inheritability of the personal element itself. In fact, it proves the exact opposite as far as healthy logic is concerned. If personal talents actually were passed down within a family, they would have to stand at the beginning of a bloodline to be transmitted to the descendants. The fact that they are present at the end, however, is evident that they are not passed down. Of course, it would be easy to misunderstand the statement that if an individual's personal gifts were simply subject to the law of heredity, they would have to appear at the beginning of a bloodline. We might say, quote, "Well, they cannot appear there because they have to develop first," unquote. This is not a valid objection, because when we want to prove that something has been inherited from a predecessor, we have to demonstrate that the predecessor's previously existing trait becomes evident again in a descendant. If it is apparent that something is present at the beginning of a bloodline and reappears later on, it would be justified to speak of heredity. But we cannot do this if something that was not present earlier shows up at the end of a bloodline. The reversal of the sentence above was only intended to show that the idea of heredity is an impossible one. This is not intended to deny the fact that those who speak of spiritual causation in life often add just as much to the confusion. They often speak in terms that are much too general and indefinite. If we say that an individual's personality is an accumulation of inherited characteristics, that can certainly be compared to the statement that a number of metal parts have assembled themselves into a clock. But it must also be admitted that many statements about spiritual worlds are no different from the statement that the parts of a clock are incapable of putting themselves together so that the hands actually move, and that therefore something spiritual must be present to make sure this movement happens. Faced with such a statement, we actually have more reason to say, quote, "I'm not going to bother any more with these quote-unquote mystical beings that move the hands of the clock. I'd rather find out about the mechanical relationships that make this happen," unquote. It is not at all a question of merely knowing that there is something spiritual, the watchmaker, behind mechanical objects, such as clocks. The only significant thing here is to become familiar with the watchmaker's thoughts, which existed before the clock was assembled. We can rediscover these thoughts in the mechanism of the clock. Merely dreaming or fantasizing about the supersensible element never gives rise to anything except confusion, because it is unable to satisfy the opponents of spiritual views, who are quite right when they say that such references to supersensible beings in the abstract do not help us understand the actual facts of the matter. Of course, these opponents may also say the same thing about the statements of spiritual science, which are specific and definite. In that case, however, we can point to how the activity of a hidden spiritual element affects our outer life. We can say, quote, suppose it's true what spiritual research claims to have established by means of observation, that during the purification period we undergo after death, our souls experience how specific actions of ours in the previous life hinder our further development, and that while we are experiencing this, we develop an impulse to make up for the consequences of these actions. Let's assume that we bring this impulse with us into a new life, and that it then shapes character traits that put us in a position to make up for what we have done. If we look at the sum total of such impulses, we then have a reason why we are born into certain surroundings as a matter of destiny. Unquote. The same can be applied to a different assumption. Once again, let's assume that spiritual science is right in saying that the fruits of a bygone life are incorporated into an individual's spiritual seed, and that in the land of spirits, where we spend the time between death and a new life, these fruits ripen so that they can be transformed into predispositions and abilities that will appear in that new life, shaping our personalities to reflect the effects of what we have gained from a prior life. If we make these assumptions and use them to observe life in an unbiased way, we will see that they make it possible for us to acknowledge all the realities of the sense world in their full truth and significance. At the same time, they clarify everything that must always remain incomprehensible to those who base themselves strictly on sense-perceptible facts while turning their attention to the spiritual world. And above all, any illogical assumptions will disappear. For instance, the one to the effect that because the most illustrious name appears at the end of a bloodline, the bearer of that name must have inherited his or her talents. The supersensible facts communicated by spiritual science make life logically comprehensible. However, conscientious truth seekers who have no personal experience in the spiritual world but are attempting to chart a course among the facts will still be able to raise an important objection by claiming that it is inadmissible to assume the validity of any fact simply because it enables us to explain something that would otherwise be unexplainable. An objection of this sort is surely totally meaningless for anyone who knows the facts in question as a result of direct supersensible perception. And later sections of this book will indicate the path people can take to become personally familiar with the law of spiritual causation, as well as with other spiritual facts that are described here. For those who do not choose to take this path, however, this objection can indeed be significant. Its refutation is also valuable for those who have decided on this path, and for them, accepting this objection in the right way is the best first step. It is absolutely true that if we have no knowledge of something, we should not assume that the thing exists simply because it explains things that would otherwise remain unexplainable. However, in the case of the spiritual facts that have been presented here, the matter is actually quite different. If we assume that these facts are true, we experience not only the intellectual result that life becomes comprehensible, but also something quite different. Let's imagine that something happens to us that causes us considerable pain and embarrassment. We can react to this in one of two ways. We can be distressed about the incident and succumb to feeling embarrassed or even be overcome with pain, or we can relate to it quite differently, telling ourselves that in a previous life we ourselves actually created the force that led us to this event. In fact, we've brought this thing upon ourselves. We can then kindle in ourselves all the feelings that are the results of a thought like this. Of course, for it to have such results for all our feelings and sensations, we have to experience this thought with the utmost sincerity and with all our strength. if we manage to do this, we will have an experience that can best be illustrated by means of a comparison. Let's assume that two people get hold of a stick of sealing wax. One of them makes intellectual comments about its quote-unquote inner nature. No matter how clever these comments are, people can easily retort that this quote-unquote inner nature is pure fantasy if it doesn't show itself in any way. But the other person rubs the sealing wax with a cloth and shows that it attracts small particles. There is a great difference between the thoughts that ran through the first person's mind and prompted his or her remarks and the thoughts of the second person. The first person's thoughts have no consequences for reality, but the second person's thoughts have lured a real thing, an actual force, out of hiding. This is also the case with imagining that a former life has implanted in us the power to encounter a certain event. Simply imagining this arouses a real force in us that allows us to meet the event in a way that is very different from how we would have met it if we had not entertained this thought. The event's inherent necessity dawns on us, whereas otherwise we would only have been able to see it as a coincidence. We will immediately understand that since what we imagined was strong enough to show us the facts of the matter, we must have had the right idea. If we repeat inner processes like this, they begin to be a source of inner strength, and their validity is confirmed by their fruitful consequences. This validity gradually becomes a force to be reckoned with. Such processes have a healing effect on spirit, soul, and body. They foster life in every respect. We become aware that while this allows us to take our place in the context of life in the right way, considering only a single life between birth and death means succumbing to delusion and falsehood, this knowledge makes our souls stronger. Although people can only produce this purely inner proof of spiritual causation for themselves through individual inner activity, it is possible for everyone to have such proof. However, those who have not produced it for themselves cannot evaluate its power to prove, while those who have produced it will no longer have any doubts about it. This need not surprise us at all. It's quite natural that such an intimate component of our innermost being, our personality, can only be adequately proved by means of the most intimate experience. However, it is not legitimate to object that since such matters conform so closely to inner experience, each person must deal with them individually, and that they are therefore not an appropriate subject for spiritual science. Of course, each person must have the experience for him or herself, just as each person must understand the solution to a mathematical equation. But the way to gain this experience holds good for all human beings, just as the method for solving a mathematical equation is valid for all. Leaving aside supersensible observations, of course, we should not deny that the above-mentioned proof, which is based on the strength-generating force of the thoughts in question, is the only one that will stand up to any unbiased logic. All other considerations are certainly very important, but they all have aspects that leave them open to attack. If we have acquired a sufficiently unbiased view, however, the fact that human beings are educable will constitute logically effective proof for us that there is a spiritual being struggling for existence within the body that envelops it. We will compare animals to human beings, telling ourselves that an animal's normal characteristics and capabilities appear definitively at birth, clearly showing how the animal's heredity predetermines it and how it will develop under the influence of the outer world. We can see how a young chick carries out vital functions in a certain way from the very moment of its birth. In human beings, however, upbringing and education establish a relationship between our inner soul activity and something that can exist without any connection to heredity. We are also capable of assimilating the effects of outer influences, and all educators know that such influences must be met by forces coming from within the person in question. If this is not the case, any attempt at education will be in vain. Unbiased educators are aware of a clear-cut boundary between inherited predispositions and the personal inner forces shining through them, which can come from earlier lives. It is true that the proofs we can advance for such things are not as quote-unquote weighty, as the proofs of certain facts of physics that can be demonstrated by means of a pair of scales. But then these are subtle and intimate aspects of our lives, and if we have a sense for them, their intangible proofs are as conclusive, or more so, than tangible reality. The objection that animals can also be trained and can acquire characteristics and faculties through education is not valid to those who are able to see the essentials. Aside from the fact that all kinds of intermediary states exist in the world, the results of training an animal do not fuse with its personal nature in at all the same way as this happens in humans. It has even been stated that the abilities domestic animals acquire through training and through living together with human beings are inheritable, that is, that they work directly on the level of the species rather than on the individual level. Darwin describes how dogs fetch and carry without being trained to do so or having seen it done. Who would make similar claims about human education? There are thinkers whose observations have made them go beyond the idea that human beings are put together from outside by means of purely hereditary forces. These thinkers have worked their way up to the idea that a spiritual being and individuality precedes and shapes our physical existence. Many of them, however, do not find it possible to grasp the existence of repeated earthly lives whose fruits are present in the interim as formative forces helping to build up the human being. Let's hear what one such thinker has to say. In his book Anthropology, Immanuel Hermann Fichte, son of the famous Fichte, cites the observations that led him to the following conclusion, quote, "In the fullest sense of the word, the parents do not produce the child. They make not only the organic substance available, but also the intermediate sensory soul element that is evident in the child's temperament, unique soul coloring, specialization of impulses and the like, whose common source is fantasy, in that broader sense that we have already established. Such a unique mixture and union of the parents' souls is unmistakable in all these elements of the personality. It is completely justifiable to explain them as purely a product of procreation, especially if, as we have concluded, procreation is to be seen as an actual soul process. But precisely the crucial central point of the personality is lacking here, for a deeper and more penetrating observation reveals that even these idiosyncrasies of mind and soul are only garments that cloak the child's real spiritual ideal predispositions, instruments that are capable of furthering or hindering the development of these predispositions, but in no way capable of creating them out of themselves." Footnote: Immanuel Hermann Fichte, 1796-1879, Anthropologie, Leipzig, 1860, pages 528 and 532. I. H. Fichte was a philosopher and edited the works of his father, philosopher Johann Gottlieb Fichte, 1762-1814, a transcendental idealist who attempted to perfect Kant's ideas. End of footnote. Further on we read, "Each person existed previously in accordance with his or her fundamental spiritual form. Spiritually considered, no individual resembles another any more than one species of animal resembles another." End quote. These thoughts go just far enough to permit a spiritual being to enter our physical bodily nature. However, since this being's formative forces are not derived from causes in previous lives, it would have to arise from a divine primal foundation each time a personality comes into existence. If we assume this to be true, there is no possibility of explaining the relationship that exists between predispositions that work their way out from inside us and what comes from our outer earthly surroundings and approaches our inner being in the course of life. The inner human being springing anew for each individual out of a divine primal foundation would have to be a total stranger to what confronts it in earthly life. For this not to be the case, as in fact it is not, the inner human being must have already been connected to the outer world. It must not be living in it for the first time. Unbiased educators can clearly perceive that they are introducing their students to results of earthly life that are indeed strange to their merely inherited traits of character, yet make them feel as if they had already taken part in the work that produces these results. If we consider the life of present-day humanity from all points of view, The only satisfactory explanation for it is provided by repeated earthly lives, and the facts that spiritual research reveals about existence in the spiritual realm between these earthly lives. The expression, quote-unquote, present-day humanity, is used quite deliberately here. Spiritual research shows that when the cycle of earthly lives first began, the conditions facing spiritual beings entering their bodily garments were quite different from what they are at present. In the following chapters, we will go back to this primeval state of humanity. Once the results of spiritual science have demonstrated how human beings took on their present form in the context of the Earth's evolution, it will then be possible to point out more precisely how the human being's essential spiritual core comes from supersensible worlds and enters its bodily garments, as well as, quote, how human destiny, unquote, as well as how, quote, human destiny, unquote, the spiritual law of causation develops. The end of chapter 3 of An Outline of Esoteric Science. The chapter is called Sleep and Death.